freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Michael Rorden is the author of An Unauthorized Biography of the World. I wanted to focus on stories that directly relate to some of the problems we are now facing in Hamilton, because history is written by those with money. Martin Kaufman's story is about why poor people are always forced to bear the brunt of pollution. Here I think of examples of the Red Hill Creek, the Rennie Dump, and outcries seen recently in the Hamilton Spectator
concerning Maple Leaf Foods and their plans for a processing plant up on Glanbrook.
When people send letters into the editor, every single one of them gives the alternative that this plant should be relocated to the North End brownfields. The North End deserves all the stink and the filth and the pollution industries. What needs to be done is to make sure that that plant either works efficiently and does not damage the environment, air-wise, water-wise, or any-wise. Our council seems to be grabbing at the quickest and the easiest solution to fill in industrial planning lots. This is the wrong way to think ahead in the future. Sylvia Hood Washington. Environmental history is written from the perspective of corporate growth, while the voices of people impacted by that growth are silent. In the early 1980s, the state government of North Carolina decided that a toxic landfill would be built in Warren County as a repository for PCB-contaminated soil from other parts of the state.
This site was chosen because it was mostly a low-income community. Another example Sylvia became aware of, she was working as an environmental engineer.
And she became increasingly uncomfortable listening to fellow engineers and their disdain for the ordinary citizens. I've seen that look of disdain on the faces of people that work for Dufferin and Dillon Consulting at the Rennie CLC meetings. They seem to be rather put out and annoyed that they have to answer questions.
Corporate engineers know that people in small community groups don't have the funds or the resources to the technical expertise that they do.
And they don't have the money to do the research that needs to be done to articulate their side of the argument. So they have no competition at all in these public hearings. In a media-soaked culture, they simply stupefy us.
And now, here's Michael Rorden.
I'm the author of An Unauthorized Biography of the World, Oral History on the Front Lines.
One of the stories has to do with Chief Isla Bussador, who's chief of the Saisi Dene in northern Manitoba. The Saisi Dene for thousands of years were nomadic people, and there was no Manitoba then. They wandered what is now the northern part of Manitoba and the southern part of Nunavut. And in 1956, the federal government, in its wisdom, decided that they shouldn't be there anymore. So arrived with two airplanes and removed the whole people without warning, and took them to the edge of Churchill, Manitoba, which a very desolate place where they could not trap, couldn't hunt, couldn't fish, couldn't do anything. And a good proportion of the Saisi Dene died over a couple of decades. Some of the survivors went back to their traditional land in the early 70s. They went without any help from the federal government, any support at all, and they kind of made their own way. And unfortunately, because they were in the third generation by then, most of the survival skills had been lost, so they faced a really tough battle just to survive on traditional land. Isla Bussador herself witnessed her parents' house with them in it burning. They burned to death in their own house one Christmas Eve in Churchill. And she decided then, she was 17, and she decided that she was going to be a vehicle for her people's voices to be heard, particularly her parents. So she ended up writing a book called Night Spirits, which is very powerful, astonishingly powerful. She and a Turkish woman, who was a journalist in Canada at the time, did a series of interviews with survivors, Saisi Dene survivors, including Isla's grandmother, who was at the time 100. Isla told me recently that she's still with us, just barely apparently, but with us, and she's still living in her own house. She said, and one of the things she said in the interview was this: when the treaty registration was over, the white man said to the Dene, "From this day on, you will never be in need of food supplies. This will always be provided for you. We'll take your land, you have a feast, and then you will celebrate this day. It's an event which is celebrated all over this country. Today, 85 years later, I live in a little matchbox house with no running water or proper heat. Of my 11 children, 9 have died alcohol-related deaths during our days of poverty in Churchill. I often wish I had a picture of my children who died so I could look back and remember what they looked like, but I don't. The white men haven't kept their promises. They have all the power now because they have our land. But as the only person alive who remembers that historic day in 1910, I have something that the white men don't have, my memory, which is as clear as it was when I was a child. I am richer than they are in that sense. I am a wealthy woman. So there's the value of oral history, because when Betsy Anderson dies, which can't be that far off, there goes her memory. So their fight goes on. They're locked in, as many First Nations are, in a land claims negotiation of sorts with the federal government. The federal government delaying, as it expertly does, but they keep at it. The way that oral history has come to be valued by the courts in a couple of key decisions, having gone from having no value in the eyes of the white power structure, who said the only thing that matters are documents because they tell the truth. And of course, guess who has all the documents? And that's the truth as it's supposed to be represented. Anyway, it's been a long struggle to try and honor oral history as a valid means of recording history. And that is actually, there's headway being made, very slow, very laborious headway. I mentioned a Turkish woman, Turkish-Canadian journalist, Üstün Bilgin Reynert. She's now back in Turkey. She worked for the CBC for a long time. Was told repeatedly that she was too passionate as a journalist. And when she was told she was too passionate, when she was doing things like being critical of the free trade deal, never when she was being supportive of official policy. So she began to fight back, and eventually, but her parents are very aged, and she went back to Turkey to be with them. And immediately, typically for her, became involved with a peasants' organization in the Bergama region of Anatolia, which is central Turkey, where people have a subsistence life growing olives. And company, well, it's been through various hands. There's a gold mine project there, has been for a long time. And in the mining of gold, cyanide and arsenic are used, which guaranteed that their land would be destroyed, their water would be poisoned. So they resisted, and they did so for 10 years with amazing success. They actually held the army at bay and the corporations at bay and the government at bay. However, they finally were just worn down and the mine went ahead. And very quickly, people started to show up with cancers. And the thing that attracted Üstün to this movement was that these were people who had never spoken out in their own villages. There was no history of that in Turkey. Peasants were silent people. But some very creative leaders got involved with this peasants' movement to stop the gold mine. And what they ended up doing was this astounding civil disobedience without any training. These people just did it, and they would do things like they would block the construction roads with doing traditional dances in traditional costume, which made it a little difficult for the soldiers, who were village guys, to knock them down and the truck drivers to drive through. Or they would go overnight by bus to the capital, and they would appear in front of the Interior Ministry in the morning, first thing in the morning, and of course the troops would come, as usual. And the older women from the village would offer them olive oil and bread to the soldiers. And again, it's hard to whack somebody who's offering you. So they got an extraordinary reputation for these kind of creative acts of civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience. Here's a short excerpt from one of the interviews that Üstün did. This is a woman called Mubera. I don't know if I pronounce her name right. Probably not. Ozyali. She's 53, and she was interviewed in the village of Kamkoy, which is right by the mine. And she said, in the beginning, women didn't go to meetings. We used to ask, "What's a meeting?" The mayor, Sefa Taskin, used to come with some men from the cities, and we used to look at them from behind our curtains. The first time I went to a meeting was when they said women should come to these meetings. There was one in the wedding hall of our village. We went there shyly, quietly. The men sat in the front, the women at the back. None of the women spoke. We didn't know Okte Konyar yet. He became the village leader. What kind of a man is this, we wondered. Soon after that first meeting, women began to go to all the meetings. Then they began to speak. And after that, women became the ones in the front lines. In the interviews, the student undertook to explore not only stories of resistance, but also what was at stake for the villagers, the texture of their daily lives working on the land. They work with the rhythms of the seasons, the light, the sun, and the rain. This is what they know. They told me that olive trees never die. If you prune them in the right way, they're immortal. I didn't know this, so I wanted to make a record of how hard they work, how grueling their lives are, and yet how they love this life, because they work with the soil and it gives back. She wrote me a couple of months ago that two major court decisions, one in the European Commission and one in the Turkish High Court, declared the mine illegal according to the Turkish Constitution, so it was stopped. And what she wrote was that today we celebrate, and what she meant is that by tomorrow the government will have figured out a way to get around these court judgments. In Peru, Diana Avila, this is Sonia Luz Rosas. One night the police arrived and took away my partner. I stayed at home, but they came to arrest me. At the anti-terrorist headquarters, they told me that various people had accused me of participating in meetings and terrorist attacks. Later, the so-called interrogations began. I held out through the punches and the near drowning. They wanted me to accept all their accusations, then later things got worse. The sexual humiliations began that took my dignity away as a woman and a mother. They tied me completely naked to a seat by my feet and arms and started to touch sensitive parts of my body. My eyes were blindfolded. At the end of 1989, I was found innocent of all charges by a court, and I was then absolved of any crime. When I got out of prison, I had to find a way to support myself and my daughter, but I could not find work. I had no choice but to sell sweets on the street. On 16 June 1994, as I was selling sweets, I was arrested again. They held me on the same charges of which I had been acquitted. I appeared on television wearing a prison uniform. The judges at the military court sentenced me to 25 years, saying I was guilty of collecting funds for the Shining Path in Lima when I was not even making enough to eat. This is part of testimony that Sonia Luz Rosas gave to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Peru in September 2002, when the Fujimori dictatorship collapsed of its own internal rot in 2000. There was a huge pressure, public pressure, for an inquiry as to how this 2 decades of genocide had happened, mostly to Quechua-speaking people in the Andes, how it could be prevented from happening again. So out of this came the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Diana Avila has been working for years as a journalist and human rights worker, community development worker, mostly with women in the Andes. And she and others worked with women who, as the women in Turkey, and they would organize small groups of women. Women wouldn't be allowed to go to these by themselves. And they would say, well, you know, that's because the women won't know what to say. We can speak for them. And after a while of these meetings, the women were saying, you know, we actually do have something to say, and it might be easier to say it without the men present. So out of these came regional meetings in which women for the first time heard each other's stories, discovered they'd been through similar things. And then finally some of them felt ready to speak on the national stage. So this was from silence to television, national television, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Very powerful testimony. 16,000 people testified, of whom the majority were women in the end. And one of the questions I asked a lot, particularly for people who were potentially in danger, as Diana Avila is, and also Ustun in Turkey, she's now proud that she's on the list of the secret police, she was told. I asked her what sustains her. Like women who testified to the Truth Commission, she doesn't have much time to dwell on her own situation. The idea that these people are working much harder than I do, she says, and that they deserve respect and that they should be able to exercise their human rights as other Peruvians do. She said, well, to think of a country in the kind of situation that we had forever, it's impossible. Things have to change so Peru can survive and develop. My youngest kid sometimes says, look at the environment, look at all the wars in the world, there's no future. I don't want that kind of feeling, I can't bear it. I need to have hope in the strength of the people to go on with their struggles. Otherwise, here, it's going to be like hell. On September 11, 2001, Mary Marshall Clark was in a taxi driving north on Broadway in New York City, just before 10 o'clock, and she heard on the radio that planes had flown into the World Trade Center. And like many people, as many people do in a disaster, she desperately wanted to figure out what she could do. She wanted to do something. So she decided within 24 hours that people were going to need to pay witness to the experience of this, and particularly to make sure that voices were heard which were people who had actually experienced this, as opposed to the official version, which took about 24 hours or so to, you've heard it, they hate us, why did they do this, they hate us for our freedoms and so on. She wanted to hear the voices of New Yorkers who went through this. So eventually 150 interviewers were involved in this huge project. They did 400 interviews, all of which are now archived. I asked her about, her motives, and she said particularly important for her was, since she knew that the official version was a lie, essentially, she wanted these other voices to be heard. This is the kind of experience. One of the interviewers that I interviewed for this project, Elizabeth Potsey Tanner, had done about 160 interviews for the Shoah Foundation with Holocaust survivors. When Elizabeth and I recorded our interview in November 2001, she was still grappling with the September 11 interview she'd conducted a few days before. Elle, worked in an office next to the World Trade Center. After the planes hit, employees were told to remain indoors. Through street-level windows, they watched bodies hit the pavement and vaporize. Then the towers collapsed one after another. Elle bolted from her building. Apparently, she lost consciousness on the sidewalk. When she woke up, she couldn't move. She was buried in dust and debris, her leg sliced by a shard of glass still embedded in it. She could hear faint voices, some screaming. Then she became aware that she was lying on another body. After some time, she has no idea how long, she struggled free. She was taken to a hospital and 2 days later sent home to recover. Co-workers traveled out to Queens to ensure that she had food. Even so, she had continued to feel as she had under the rubble, she told Elizabeth. Alone, silent, buried alive. When interviewers did these interviews, they're asked not to begin with the obvious question, where were you, what happened to you on September 11th, but to begin with the question, could you tell me something about your life? And in that context, then they went to September 11th. So when Elizabeth asked Elle this question, Elle said that her back had been broken in her teens, and since then she'd lived with a scoliosis, a twist in the spine. She had 7 siblings, but had had no contact with any of them. She'd been in an intimate relationship once, but fled. She loved children, but had none. She screened her calls. This woman is painfully aware of how she's cutting herself off from life, but she hasn't found any way to get out of the cage that she's building for herself. Elle hinted at another trauma earlier in life, but declined to offer details. The damaged spine seemed like such a powerful metaphor to me, says Elizabeth. This is someone whose ability to stand up for herself has effectively been broken. The way this project worked is they tried to get as many interviews with as many people as possible, as fast as possible, right after when memory was still fresh, before it was too influenced by the media. And then 2 years later, the interviewers were asked to revisit anybody who was willing to do so, do another interview and see how their memory had been shaped by external pressures. Elizabeth did that, and I did the same thing. I interviewed the interviewers 2 years later. I asked Elizabeth particularly about Elle, and Elizabeth said it was extraordinary. She was completely transformed. She'd come out of her cage, and she was going out, she was social. Elizabeth said there's no way to know this, but it seems likely that the telling of her story for the first time to anybody may have been the set free a little bit. So I asked Mary Marshall Clark, the woman who directed this project, 2 years later also, about what she'd said earlier on about wanting the witnesses to be a counter to the official version, whether that was still the case, because I feel that more than ever. You can hardly find a single interview where a person who saw the incredible violence that day calls for revenge, she says. The things people saw, human bodies as bombs, jumpers coming out of windows killing people when they landed, legs falling, hands falling, people pushing each other down in the streets to get away, all the things that happened in the catastrophe that you never want to remember again. When you've lived through that, when you've witnessed it, you don't ever want to imagine that any other person could go through what you went through. So we don't find vengeance narratives in the interviews. We find people searching for solace, for peace, people saying over and over, please God, don't let this happen to anyone else. Even when people said they wanted to attack Afghanistan, you'll find a few minutes later that they say in the interview, no, I didn't really mean that. Some people actually say, I'm afraid that our experience will be used by the government to promote a war of retaliation. I think these stories will affect people powerfully, says Mary Marshall. They'll serve as a reminder that the public meaning the United States government has imposed on 9/11 is entirely its own invention. The last person I'll introduce you to, Efrat Ben-Zeev. We met in New York, she and I, in 2001 at an oral history seminar at Columbia University. Efrat was born in Israel. She became an anthropologist. But she, like everybody in Israel, is subject to military service, 2 years military service. And like most women, I think this may be changing, but she would be in a non-combat position. So she was a guide on the Mount Carmel Ridge, taking mostly children around to these historic geological, botanical sites. And she would tell them about the biblical history of the land and the Crusades and the empires, the Turkish, the British, and the liberation in 1948, Israel. That's it. That's all they heard. And she began to realize, being a inquisitive person, although she's surprised herself at how long it took her, that there were other unexplained evidences in the landscape. So, remnants of mosques, remnants of wells, olive trees, which had predated, obviously, 1948, olive groves, terraces, which had been built, obviously, not accounted for by any of these stories. So she began to investigate and essentially discovered Palestinians. Amazing, she says. Both her theses were our oral history. She gathered stories of people whose villages were destroyed in 1948 by the Israeli army, of which her father was an officer. And as she heard these stories, her own sense of the complexity of her own country deepened, and she kind of rewrote the map of Israel in her mind. Here's what I heard from her 2 months later. In February 2002, Efrat reported her first encounter with the Israeli police. They had piled up a wall of mud and stone across the only road into Isawiya, an Arab village near the university. As these blockades do throughout the West Bank, it functioned as a prison. When a group of Israeli Jewish and Arab activists set out to dismantle the roadblock, a friend persuaded Efrat to go along. "I don't usually get involved this way," she says, "but this village is just 200 meters beyond the valley near my home. I can see it from my balcony." The police called in reinforcements and charged the crowd. "No one really hit me badly," she says, "but I did fall to the ground, and then I got pulled up violently by a policeman who wanted me to move away. They hate it when you're on the ground, especially when there are photographers present. As soon as the policeman let go of me, this woman took me to the side. She was younger than me, probably a student, and Palestinian. It seemed she'd been through these things before. And it reminds me that the dividing line is not the national one. But still, the more I touch on the real things that are going on here, the more I lose hope. Even the violence and hatred that I felt within myself towards that policeman who was holding me now worries me." Since then, she has become involved with an organization called Tayush, which describes itself as an Arab-Jewish partnership for peace. And it's the most radical peace organization in Israel by far. One of the ways that the Israeli army and the settlers have of destroying Palestinian communities is to smash the waterworks. Well, in the Middle East, you don't survive a day without water. So Tayush recruited plumbers, and they would go and reconnect the waterworks, and the bulldozer would come and break them again, and they would go and reconnect them. This is under the guns of the settlers, by the way, but they're less willing to shoot Israelis than they are Palestinians. Efrat reported that she had been one day picking olives with Palestinian women because of the wall, the terrible wall which is being built across Israel. Their lands had been cut off. They'd been cut off from their lands and couldn't get there on their own, but they could with an Israeli. So she went, and others, some progressive rabbis went and picked olives with these women. Their husbands had been killed in the Intifada, and they had no way to survive other than the olives. This wall, which creeps ahead day by day, one of the terrible things about it, aside from its other very direct effects on Palestinians, is that it is cutting people off from each other. Like Tayush, I mean, it's The whole idea of Taiyush is it's to put a lie to the fact that these people are enemies with each other, Israelis and Palestinians, forever and always. But as the wall closes off connections, it becomes more and more difficult. So she's writing me about how she has to write to me early in the morning before the helicopters are flying overhead because it's too noisy and it wakes the kids up, and then this and that happens. And recently she was in a big battle at her kid's school because the other parents wanted to hire another security guard, and she argued that what is needed is not more security guards because we can't be protected from terrorist attacks. What is needed is, in fact, for people to talk to Palestinians. Well, she was called a traitor and a pacifist, and what the other parents did was that they wouldn't let their children play with her children. That was how they punished her. So I write back as well as I can. She said, am I crazy? I'm a crazy woman. I'm fighting for these things, and my children are suffering for it. And I said, well, it seems to me that you're doing two things right, as far as I can understand. I'm not a parent myself, but it seems to me it's right that you should be telling your children the truth. And also, you're trying to make a world in which they can live properly, decently, and with self-respect. In one of her emails, Efrat wrote, there is so little hope here, so much despair, not only from the fate of the conflict, but also from what it has done to us and our morality. But she's told me she can't function without hope. I want to know, where does she find it? What sustains her? I'm not optimistic, she says. I have few signs of hope. But I think I have two choices. Either I really try to shed my Israeli identity and come to Picton and have a nice rural house and teach at a small university, or I remain in Israel. In a way, I think that's inescapable for me, and then I feel obliged to participate where I am. The situation is so bad here, and such bad things are coming out of humanity. I do not want to be a passive person who only participates by passivity.
And we know now what's happening in Israel and the Gaza Strip. Those Israelis are being forced out of their homes that they've been living in for 40 years. I wanted to correct an announcement that was on last week's show. The End of Suburbia documentary is appearing at the Ewart Angus Center that's just off the Health Sciences Building in Theater Room 1A1. It is not October the 8th. It is now on Saturday, October the 15th. So that's Saturday, October 15th. You got lots of time. This artist, I heard a course on Free Wheel and Folk Show on Saturdays. That's the Jim Marino Show. And this is Andrea Ravel.
Flying Radio.
CFM.